Nathan would accompany me when I went to the market. This happened so seldom that it was always an occasion, and to round it off, we would go to the tannery to see our sons. They invariably came out at midday for their meal, and we would sit with them for a few minutes, talking, while they ate their rice and enjoyed the rest. Then one day, a bright, soft morning with a whisper of rain in it, we got there to find the gates closed and the guards posted midday along the iron railings that encircled the compound. Midday, mid-afternoon, still no sign of the workers. At last I pluck up my courage to inquire one of the guards. It needs courage, for they are in uniform, and they have lathis strapped to their wrists. The first one is surly. "Begone! I have no time for idle woman." The next swings his lathi jauntily. He does not know anything. He will not say. So to the next. He is a big, hefty fellow, and he looks down at me and says there has been trouble. The workers will not be out today. No, not even to eat. My knees turn to water. "What trouble?" I stammer. "Are my sons in it?" He shakes his head. He does not know. My husband is behind me. He supports me a little with his arm, and we go home and wait. At last they come, long after dusk, with the faces of angered men, though neither is 20. "What has happened?" we asked with trepidation. "They are still our sons, but suddenly they have outgrown us." "Trouble," they say. "We asked for more money, and they took from us our eating time." I bring out some dried fish and rice cakes. They are ravenous. "More money," I say. "What for? Do they not pay you well enough already?" "What for?" one echoes. "Why, to eat our fill and to marry, and for the sons we shall beget." And the other says, "No, it is not enough." I do not know what reply to make. These men are strangers. Nathan said we do not understand. We must not interfere. He takes my hand and draws me away. To his sons, he is gentle. Into the calm lake of our lives, the first stone has been tossed. Looking back now, I wonder how it came to pass that not until that fateful day did we realize the trouble that had been brewing. No gossip. Not a whisper had come to us of the meetings the men had held at which my sons had been spokesmen, nor of the agitation that followed, nor of the threats by the owners, there were now four, of the tannery. All this we only heard later. Then one day they did not go to work. "We shall not go back until our demands are met," Thombi said. "All the workers have stopped. We do not ask for charity, but for what which is our due." "How can you force them?" I said. "Are they not masters? For every one of you who is out, there are three waiting to step into your place." "We will see," he replied in a hard voice, and I dared to say no more. When a whole week has passed thus, the tannery officials called a meeting to announce that those who did not return to work would be replaced. My sons came home from that meeting even more silent, if possible, than they had been in the past. This was the rest. And it failed. The next morning, the tannery had its full completement again. Most of them, workers who had gone back, the remainder of men who were too glad to obtain employment. For so long, hope that the heat of battle had sustained Arjun and Thambi. Now there was only bitterness. "The people will never learn," Arjun said savagely. "They will rot before they do." "People will never learn." Kenny had said it, and I had not understood. Now here were my own sons saying the same thing, and still I did not understand. What was it we had to learn? To fight against tremendous odds? What was the use? One only lost the little one had. Of what use to fight when the conclusion is known? I asked myself and got no answer. I went to my husband, and he was perplexed twice over. Of course, ours was not the only family involved. There were several others. Among them Callie's, and she came to moan with the result. 2 more months to feed, she complained. One of my three sons had the sense to go back. I do not know what is to become of us, for the land cannot sustain us all. So much for reading and writing, she said, accusing me with the eye and finger. Did I not say no good would come of it? Now look into what mess your sons have led us. Ay, and out of it to better things, said Thambi with flint in his voice. But for spawn like yours who have sold themselves cheaper than dirt. You will speak with respect, I cried, or else. Then Nathan interrupted, so violently that I started. "Enough," he shouted. "More than enough has been said. Our children must act as they choose to, not for our benefit." "Is it not enough that they suffer?" The veins on his forehead were bulging. I had never seen him so angry before. Callie went away, then the men too, father and sons, leaving me alone, who had no understanding. Once more, Nathan was the sole provider for us, and we forgot the good living we had known. The reserves of grain I had put by began to dwindle despite my care. Fortunately, harvest time was near, and I consoled myself with the thought of it. Our Hunanthambi began to frequent the town more and more, coming and going at all hours with no words as to what they did, and I suffered in silence, for I knew they had no money to lead them to harm, and I had no cure for the restlessness that afflicted them. One morning, I was laying out some clothes to dry in the sun when Selvam came running in, his face hot and excited. "Tom-toms are beating," he announced breathlessly. "The town is full of drummers. They are calling for men." I stopped my work and gazed at him, and all at once my heart turned over. It was as if a scene long past were occurring again. This was not Selvam, but our Hoon, and he was telling me not of drummers, but of bullock carts bringing the tannery to us brick by brick. I passed my hand over my eyes, feeling slightly giddy. "Come and see, come quickly," the boy was saying, eager and unnoticing. The others crowded round and repeated this story with relish. He had roused his brother's interest, and I was forgotten. When they had gone, a triumphant Selvam in the van, and the place was quiet, I did indeed hear the drums, muffled and distant, insistently calling. Well, I had thought, if it concerns me, I shall hear soon enough, and if not, I shall have saved myself a walk. With so ordinary things I sought to still my qualms. "They are calling for laborers," Arhun said, not looking up. "It would be a good opportunity for us." Only Arhun and Thambi, who had stayed in the town until nightfall, and my husband were up. The others were long asleep. "They are paying well," Arhun resumed. "It would be good for us to work again. It is not fitting that men should corrupt themselves in hunger and idleness." "I have heard," said Nathan. "The labor is required of you not here, but in the island of Ceylon." "Yes, it is work in the tea plantations of Ceylon. You may not have the knowledge for such work. They will teach us. They have said so. Who will pay for the journey? Is it not many of hundreds of miles?" "True. They will arrange everything, and everything will be paid for." So Nathan was silenced, for he saw they were men and had to make their decisions. But how could I let them go, who were my own flesh and blood, without a fight? "Promises," I said, "fair words. Who is to see if they are honored? What is to happen if they are broken?" "They need labor," Arhun said dryly. "Self-interest alone will keep these promises." "What is it that calls you?" I said. "Is it gold? Although we have none, remember that money is not everything." "It is an important part of living," he answered me patiently, "and work is another. There is nothing for us here, for we have neither the means to buy land nor to rent it. Would you have us wasting our youth chafing against things we cannot change?" "Indeed, no," I said. "But Ceylon is a distant land. Its people are not ours. How will you fare?" "No worse than here," they replied. "No worse than here." The wick was sputtering in the oil. There were only a few drops left in the coconut shell, but there was none to replenish it. We sat on in the darkness. Then at last I made one more effort. "If you go, you will never come back," I cried. "The journey costs hundreds of rupees. You will never have so much." The tears came, hot and bitter, flowing and flowing as if the very springs of sorrow had been touched in my body. They spoke soothingly of how much they would earn and how one day they would return, as one does to a child. And I listened to them. And it was all a sham, a poor, shabby pretense to mask our tortured feelings. They left at first daylight, each carrying a bundle with food in it, and each before he went kissed Nathan's feet, then mine, and we laid our hands on them in blessing. I knew we would never see them again. "They are growing up," Nathan said. "Would you have them forever at your breast?" "Ah, no," I said wearily. "They must go on their way. Only it seems to me their way lies far from here." Two sons have gone, now the third is going, and not to the land which is in his blood, but to be a servant, which he has never been. What does he know of such work? He will learn, said Nathan. He is quick and has an agile brain. Should you not be thankful that he goes no further than 2 days' journeying, and that it is a good house that takes him? Kenny himself has assured you of that. You should be grateful that he has recommended our son. I am indeed, I said, flat and dispirited. He has done much for us. You brood too much, Nathan said, and think only of your trials, not of the joys that are still with us. Look at our land. Is it not beautiful? The fields are green and the grain is ripening. It will be a good harvest year. There will be plenty. He coaxed me out into the sunlight, and we sat down together on the brown earth that was part of us. And we gazed at the paddy fields spreading rich and green before us. And they were indeed beautiful. The air was cool and still, yet the paddy caught what little movement there was, leaning slightly one way and the next with soft whispering. At one time there had been kingfishers here, flashing between the young shoots for our fish, and paddy birds, and sometimes, in the shallower reaches of the river, flamingos, striding with ungainly precision among the water reeds, with plumage of a glory not of this earth. Now birds came no more, for the tannery lay loose, except crows and kites and such scavenging birds, eager for the town's offal, or sometimes a palpita, skimming past with raucous cry but never stopping, perhaps dropping a blue-black feather in flight to delight the children. Nathan went and plucked a few green stems and brought them to me. See how firm and strong they are? No sign of disease at all. Look, the grain is already forming. I took the paddy from him and parted the grass, and there within its protective husk lay the rice grain, just big enough to see, white, perfect, and holding it in itself our lives. It promises a good harvest, he repeated eagerly. We shall be able to pay the landlord and eat, and perhaps even put by a little. We may even make enough to visit our son. Would that not be good? Thus he sought to comfort me, and after a time I was with him, thinking pleasurably of harvesting and of plucking the pumpkins swelling on the vine and visiting our son, and so we made our plans. Before long, Kenny brought me new news of my third son. He was doing well, he said. His employer was well pleased with his work. He would be well looked after, and I had no cause for his anxiety. The boy would soon be writing to me himself. It is very kind of you to tell me, I said. You have done much for me and mine. It is nothing, he said. You ask little. I glanced at him, sitting there in our hut with his long, haggard face and eyes like a kingfisher's wing, living among us who were not his people, in a country not his own, and of a sudden I was moved to ask him if he was indeed alone. Alone, he said. I am never alone. Do you not see the crowds always at my door? Have you ever known me to lack a following? I did not mean that, I said quietly, waiting. He did not reply at once. His face had shriveled. I have offended him, I thought. Panic overcame me. Why did I have to speak? The silence deepened. Then at last he looked up. I am surprised you have not asked me before, he said. It is many years since I saw you in your mother's house. Well, I thought, if I have not asked, it is because I have not dared. There is a look about you that is quelling, and your manner forbids such talk. I said awkwardly, I have thought about it more than once, but it is not my place to ask questions. You come and go, and it is your concern. I do not know what made me ask you now. Yet since you have asked, I will tell you, he said. I have the usual encumbrances that men have. Wife, children, home. That would be put chains around me, but I resisted. And so I am alone. As for coming and going, I do as I please. For am I not my own master? I work among you when my spirit wills it. I go when I am tired of your follies and stupidities, your eternal shameful poverty. I can only take you people, he said, in small doses. I was silent, taking no offense. Barbed words, but what matter from one so gentle? Harsh talk from one in whom the springs of tenderness gushed abundant, as I knew. I told you what I did in a moment of lunacy, he said. I do not want it repeated. I am not cursed with a gossip's tongue, I said, annoyed. I would never repeat what you have said. Never. Understand? I understand. He rose to his feet, and without another word, was gone, walking with long, quick strides and stooping a little, as always. A strange nature, only partly within my understanding. A man half in shadow, half in light, defying knowledge. Chapter 13. That year, the rains failed. A week went by, too. We stared at the cruel sky, calm, blue, indifferent to our need. We threw ourselves on the earth and we prayed. I took a pumpkin and a few grains of rice to my goddess, and I wept at her feet. I thought she looked at me with compassion, and I went away comforted, but no rain came. Perhaps tomorrow, my husband said, it is not too late. We went out and scanned the heavens, clear and beautiful, deadly beautiful. Not one cloud to mar the serenity. Others did so too, coming out as we did, to gaze at the sky and murmur, perhaps tomorrow. Tomorrows came and went, and there was no rain. Nathan no longer said perhaps. Only a faint spark of hope, obstinately refusing to die, brought him out each dawn to scour the heavens for a sign. Each day the level of water dropped and the heads of the paddy hung lower. The river had shrunk to a trickle. The well was as dry as a bone. Before long, the shoots of the paddy were tipped with brown. Even as we watched, the stain spread like some terrible disease, choking out the green that meant life to us. Harvesting time, and nothing to reap. The paddy had taken all our labor and lay now before us in faded, useless heaps. Sivaji came to collect his master's dues, and his face fell when he saw how much we lost, for he was a good man and he felt for us. There is nothing this year, Nathan said to him, not even gleanings, for the grain was but little advanced. You have had the land, Sivaji said, for which you have contracted to pay. So much money, so much rice. These are just dues. I must have them. Would you have me return empty-handed? Nathan's shoulders sagged. He looked tired and dispirited. I came and stood beside him. Ira and the boys crouched near us defensively. There is nothing, Nathan repeated. Do you not see the crops are dead? There has been no rain, and the river is dry. Yet such was the contract, else the land would not have been rented to you. What would you have me do? The last harvest was meager, and we have nothing saved. Sivaji looked away. I do not know. It is your concern. I must do as I am bid. What then? The land is to be given to another if you cannot make payment. Go from the land after all these years? Where would we go? How would we live? It is your concern. I have my orders, and I must obey them. Nathan stood there, sweating and trembling. Give me time, he said at last humbly, until the next crop. I will pay then somehow. Pay half now, Sivaji said, and I will try and do as you wish. He spoke quickly, as to give himself no time to repent of his offer, and hurried away even before my husband had assented. No easy job for him, I said. He is answerable, even as we are. That is why he and his kind are employed, Nathan said bitterly, to protect their overlords from such unpleasant tasks. Now the landlord can wring us from his monies and care not for the misery he evokes, for indeed it would be difficult for any man to see another starve, and his wife and children as well, or to enjoy the profits born of such travail. He went into the hut and I followed. A few mud pots and two brass vessels, the tin trunk I had brought with me as a bride, the two shirts my eldest sons had left behind, two old locks of dal, and a handful of dried chilies left over from better times. These we put together to sell. Rather these should go, said Nathan, than the land should be taken from us. We can do without these, but if the land is gone, our livelihood is gone, and we must thenceforth wander like jackals. He stared a while at what we had to sell, and made an effort to say something, and tried again, and at last he said, choking, the bullocks must go, otherwise we shall not have enough. But when we had added them and reckoned and re-reckoned, there was still not enough. There are some saris left, I said, good ones and hardly worn, and these we must sell. I brought out the red sari I had served for both my wedding and my daughter's, and the sari and dhoti had brought when Tambi worked at the tannery, made a parcel of them and set out. Ah, Rukmani, said Biswas with false welcome. What brings you here?